We're going to start today with Sinclair Schuller. He's the CEO and co-founder of Aprenda. And I met Sinclair a while ago. I'm thinking 2 or 3 years ago. I can't remember exactly, but it was a very interesting discussion about a company that Sinclair founded and has scaled somewhat from a somewhat unlikely location, which is upstate New York. So I know we have a global audience of entrepreneurs, and I thought it would be great and inspiring for you to meet Sinclair. So welcome, Sinclair. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much.
So tell us about Aprenda. What do you do? Let's set the context first.
Yeah, maybe I can answer that first in the context of the world around us today. It's usually important, I think, to capture that. And as consumers, we expect that everything's driven by software now, right? You can't buy anything that doesn't have a software component associated with it. And what that has ended up creating is this tremendous demand for companies to build more and more software applications to satisfy different niche use cases that they might have. And if you look at the world's largest companies, traditionally they really aren't built for high-velocity software production, right? They don't really have the IT department, software expertise in many cases, to deliver what the market wants. And this is why Silicon Valley exists. You see lots of innovation happening in the Valley, but the world's largest companies have never really behaved in that sort of way. And a lot of it is because the way that IT is structured inside these really large companies isn't conducive to innovation and building and releasing new software very quickly. So what should take a few days, getting from idea to a piece of software commercializable and useful to people, takes months and months. So what we've done at Aprenda is we've created a technology platform that will take all of the assets of an IT department, the data centers, the public cloud usage, and turn that into an application platform that allows for a tremendous amount of throughput. So if you have 1,000 or 2,000 developers at your company and you want to build lots of apps quickly, then our platform enables them to very, very quickly be productive, get new applications out the door, and be successful, instead of the old IT approach, which, again, could take months and months to build even a simple application versus the days that it should take. So effectively, we're an app platform company focused on developer productivity.
And you have built this company, as we introduced you with, you've built this company from upstate New York. How did you do it? How did this come together? What's the genesis of the company?
Yeah, so it's a pretty interesting story. I worked as a software developer at Morgan Stanley, and in banking, you know, people don't realize this, but there's lots of software innovation. If you think of the fact that you can take a picture of a check with your phone now and deposit it, you understand how technology is impacting that industry. And when I was at Morgan Stanley, I started to see on a regular basis that we were under more pressure to deliver new software applications, but as I discussed earlier, the machinery inside a place like Morgan Stanley wasn't really built for delivering lots of apps quickly. So seeing that as a problem, I left Morgan Stanley and decided with my co-founders to start Aprenda to solve this issue. And we actually lived in upstate New York. I went to university in upstate New York, but also grew up here. And originally, when we said, all right, we're going to build this company, the first thought was we have to move to Silicon Valley. Like, there's no way to build a software company otherwise. And what we started to realize was that we were actually potentially in a position of success by staying in upstate New York because we were close to the customer. Sometimes people separate themselves from that, right? They look at building the company exclusively around access to capital and access to talent, and both of those are important things. But in my opinion, the most important thing is being close to the customer. And when you look at New York City and the Northeast in general, the density of large enterprise companies that are, you know, Fortune 1000 class companies is tremendous, very high. So that was a motivating factor for us. And we started to build the business. At that point, we were about six people in the company. And we still had this mentality that we had to move to the Valley. But then we started to see that we could have lots of successful customer conversations by staying. And inertia kept us here. We just kept building the business, and this idea that we had to move started to go away because of this tremendous advantage we had by being so close to the customer.
So can you actually double-click down on that a bit? We are huge fans of your methodology, which is, you know, customer first and everything else second, investor included. Investors are optional, customers are not. So in your work with the early customers, how did you go about, this is, you know, the product that you were building is not a very simple product. It's not something that you can just kind of cobble together. It does take some time to build something complex like that. What was the arrangement with customers? Were they giving you advances? Do you have a little bit of personal funding, or savings, friends and family? How did you get to the first product which allowed you to start generating revenues from these customers who were expressing interest?
Yeah, so first, you're absolutely right. It's a very complex product, lots of R&D. We're effectively a data center operating system, right? So you can imagine that the lead time to having something that a customer can use was a while. It actually took us about 2 years. But the path to getting to those first customers, I think, could be broken up into three stages. First, my co-founders and I bootstrapped quite a bit. We invested a lot of personal energy and money in making sure that we could get a prototype built. And that was, you know, the simplest mechanism, get that prototype. And it was enough where we felt confident enough that it was okay to ask friends and family for money. So we had raised about $200,000 in friends and family money early on and used that to start hiring our first one or two additional developers in addition to the development work that we were doing. And then we were also fortunate enough to have a seed stage investor, an actual institutional investor here in upstate New York. At the time, their name was High Peaks Ventures, now known as Primary Ventures. And we walked them through what we had built with friends and family money and the fact that we had actual customer interest and that we had raised $500,000 in seed stage at that point. And that was all over the course of about 18 or 20 months. So the path to getting something that customers would use was really driven by those three phases, bootstrapping, friends and family, and then seed stage.
Yeah, so you did a little bit of local financing to get to paying customers as well before you did any kind of fundraising in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we realized that it's very difficult to show up in the Valley and differentiate yourself. In fact, you have things working against you. You are in upstate New York. You're not in the Valley.
Right.
So we needed to reach a point where we had something meaningful to show. And it wasn't just about the product, but we wanted to make sure that we had some customers that they could have a conversation with. Yeah.
And how many customers were you able to close before you decided to pursue funding in Silicon Valley?
At the time, it was about just three customers. Now, this is a very big, intensive product, so having two or three customers that are at least prototyping and piloting with your technology is pretty good. We didn't have to have, you know, dozens or hundreds. In that case, that'd be pretty infeasible for us.
And these were three large customers, though, right?
Correct. I mean, everybody we work with tends to be household brand. You know, these are large banks, large pharmaceutical companies, large defensive manufacturing companies.
So now you eventually raised money from NEA here in Silicon Valley, but you didn't have to move your company headquarters to the Valley. How did that conversation go? Because that's very often becomes a point of contention in this VC entrepreneur dialogue when people are raising money with, you know, companies elsewhere.
Yeah, it was definitely a little bit of a challenge. So when we decided in 2009 to raise our first, you know, meaningful round of money, we kind of built out our business plan and said we need $5 million for these, you know, these milestones that we're trying to achieve. And at the time, I had no connections in the space. I came from a rural community and didn't really have access to investors. So I reached out at that point to, I think it was about 52 different VC funds. With a really simple pitch. It was cold calling. It was, hey, this is what we're doing. This is an exciting business we're trying to build. Are you interested? And we started to get a few people actually respond. And I'll never forget, I reached out to NEA, to Pete Cincini, and I pulled one of those lines like, yeah, I'm actually going to be in Silicon Valley this week. Why don't I stop by? I wasn't really going to be in Silicon Valley. He said, sure, stop by. Sounds great. So I had to scramble and buy a plane ticket and make my way out to the Valley to go meet him. But I think, you know, point of the story is that it's like a sales process or a sales pipeline. I don't think that you're doomed to not raise capital and not if you're not in the Valley, just that the coverage requirement is a lot higher. You have to have more at-bats if you're going to hit anything. So the fact that we tried to communicate to 52 different funds was, I think, the meaningful part of the story. And you will eventually get people that pay attention who don't look at location as the most important qualifier. Rather, is this a big business in a big market that we think we should be involved in? And that's the number one goal as an entrepreneur, is communicate that to an investor so that they can understand the magnitude of the potential success.
There's also a way of short-circuiting that by getting introduced by people who know these firms and characters in this process. So you took the cold calling route, but cold calling is not the fastest way to get introduced to VCs. A warm introduction is a much better way to do that. Nonetheless, it worked. And then you were able to convince NEA that you were going to stay in Rochester. How did you do that?
Yeah, so that was another interesting conversation, and it's a conversation that I had with any of the VCs that were taking a serious look at Apprenda at that point. The conversation, I think, was pretty focused on what we talked about earlier. I explained, look, we're very close to our customer at this point. I can be in the Valley, and I can email any one of you and arrange a lunch, but then if I want to go talk to a customer where, you know, I have to have a high bandwidth communication with these customers, I have to get on a plane and travel to New York.
Yeah.
Or to Boston. Right. You know, it's not that there aren't large enterprises on the West Coast, but again, the density is very high. So walking them through that process, I think, was helpful. And then second, we were in 2009, I would say that we really started to enter an era where people got more comfortable with digital
yeah.
communication as a means to make mm-hmm. things happen.
Significantly.
And then third, I do think that there's something to be said for the fact that that I had a local investor. You know, we did have somebody from their world, a VC, who put in seed stage money that could act as a bit of a bridge between, you know, an entrepreneur who was on the East Coast in upstate New York and where they were in the Valley. So having, I think, a local investor through High Peaks was pretty fantastic for us in getting our NEA deal done.
Now, this choice of staying put in upstate New York, from a customer point of view, you have explained abundantly. What were the other pros and cons of that decision vis-a-vis talent? What were the other angles of that decision? How did it pan out?
Yeah, so there are certainly lots of pros and cons to doing this. So one pro that I think is important, aside from the customer side of things, is that it's an environment that I think is pretty balanced. When you're in the Valley, everything is technology focused, and there's nothing wrong with that, but you have an element of non-technical conversation that happens in upstate New York or even in New York City, where one of our offices are now. And I think it's refreshing to people who are dedicating their heart and soul to a company. They're spending 10, 12, 14 hours a day working. But then when they leave work, they are in a different context. They can relax and kind of participate in a world that isn't tech. And what I think that's led to, which is a huge pro, is we have very high retention at the company. I think we do a good job as a culture of making sure that, you know, we value the people that are here. But I think another part of it is that you get to unplug for a little bit, and when you're outside of the Apprenda environment, it doesn't have to be another technology conversation, because I generally do believe that can burn people out, not from a workload perspective, but rather from the need to fulfill other interests, right? So I think that's been pretty big for us.
Well, I was going to ask, what does the community, the hinterland of talent look like? I know you have good universities around there. Do people actually want to live in that area and build their lives and raise their families in that area, et cetera?
They do, and that was actually the second component of this, is that you find that in upstate New York especially, it tends to be a pretty good place to raise families. So when people are leaving university, entering their life, they think about all of these things. They think about a professional career. They think about, you know, maybe they are married or they're getting married or they're starting a family, whatever it might be. The quality of life component tends to be fairly high. So we do have a pretty high abundance of talent in the universities. And then second, a lot of people are local. They go to a local university and they want to stay close to their current family. But now they have a Silicon Valley-esque job in their backyard. So I think that ends up creating a level of affinity for that type of talent. And, you know, I think that part of it is pretty important. Now, the challenge, the con, is that clearly there aren't as many software developers or enterprise, managers who have managed enterprise software businesses in upstate New York. So we have to be a little more creative when it comes to that, right? We need to make sure that the labor pool is bigger than just upstate for us.
And so what do you do? Do you move people? Are people willing to move?
Yeah, we've moved people. We've actually moved people from the Valley to Albany. We've moved people mm-hmm. from basically the Atlantic coast up and down to Albany and also to New York City. And that was the other mm-hmm. component of it. It was be liberal with moving people. Be sure that you can give good relocation packages and that you can get people excited to understand the value of being here. But then second, mm-hmm. we also have to be realistic. And we opened an office in New York City. We now have about 30 employees there. And it gives an alternative to upstate New York. It's still close to the customer, still has all of the primary values that we talked about. But if you want to live in one of the best cities on earth, you have access to that now, too, through Apprenda. So we wanted to make sure that we could branch out and have a company that has this dual head, that has the ability to attract talent based on what you want out of your life. If you want to be in a rural area or a city area, you have those options.
And how many do you have in upstate New York? You have 30 people in New York City. How many people do you have in upstate New York?
We're about 70 in upstate New York, and then about 20 or so remote. I have a lot of in-territory salespeople on the West Coast, East Coast, mm-hmm. in Europe. So we're 120 employees now at the company.
So upstate New York is a substantial operation.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's not a small operation, and a lot of our software development and client support happens out of headquarters. So.
That's awesome. And what about capital? I know you've raised more funding since the NEA round. What has been your experience in terms of access to scaling capital?
Yeah, so we've raised $55 million total so far since mm-hmm. 2009. And I think once you figure out how to get that initial institutional round done, our Series A with NEA, and we could use that money to demonstrate more traction, access to capital became much easier. I think it became easier for other investors on the West Coast to look at a Northeast company in upstate New York and say, hey, we should make a bet. Part of that is that they don't feel alone in that context anymore, right? Somebody else already took that first step.
Absolutely. But especially if you're delivering on the customer metrics, if you're adding customers, growing the business, that's all becomes very easy at some point.
Yep. Absolutely.
And what is the customer acquisition strategy? How do you, how do customers find you, or how do you find customers and opportunities? What kind of average deal size are you selling at? What is the sweet spot of the customer?
Yeah, great question. So like any company, we really have sales broken up into direct and indirect models. A majority of our business is direct, meaning we have account managers in territory that work with these customers day in and day out. Mm-hmm. That tends to be driven by our own organic marketing, making sure that we're top of mind in the press when it comes to cloud platforms, typical lead generation campaigns. Now, the indirect business is driven through a partner strategy, typically with very large technology vendors. So, for example, Cisco is one of our larger partners, and mm-hmm. Cisco has the right to resell our technology, so we're plugged into the Cisco sales team in a meaningful way. And I think mm-hmm. that gives us access to scale. So while we might get depth through direct business, we get scale through the indirect business, and that helps us build a pretty meaningful sales pipeline.
Why Cisco? Cisco is not a big system integration company, why Cisco? It's not the first company that comes to mind that I would think of as a partner for Apprenda.
Yeah, so it's interesting because when you look at somebody building out their own hybrid cloud, one of the first things they think about is the networking component, right? How do we think about the network? How do we take things like AWS and Azure and our internal network and unify them in a meaningful way? And Cisco mm-hmm. has invested a lot of energy in that. And then number two, Cisco also has a deep belief, the same belief we do, that these companies are going through meaningful digital transformation. They're becoming software companies. And their strategy is anchored around that. So there's a natural strategic alignment. It's not about what Cisco has done in the past, but rather what they're looking at for a future state for their customers.
Interesting.
Microsoft is the same. They're also a partner of ours. So you can see that alignment with somebody who is a bit more natural, right? A Microsoft is certainly.
Yes, Microsoft is more natural.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how long did it take you to hit your stride in terms of finding a repeatable sales model, scalable, repeatable sales model?
So that took a little time. I would say from 2009 to 2011, we had a rough time because we were focusing on the wrong market. So for those first 2 years, we were actually trying to sell to independent software vendors. We felt that going after ISVs was a good beachhead, and enterprise was a little too difficult, right? It's too big. The sales process is too long. And mm-hmm. we have a good number of ISV customers now, and they're great to work with. But as a focal point for us, as a starting point for the market, it was the wrong spot. The reason it was the wrong spot to start is that a software company is going through this transition of moving from on-premises to cloud. Is a pretty complex core to their business, so the duration of a sales cycle was very long. Mm-hmm. In 2011, we decided to put our emphasis primarily on the enterprise business and instead make ISVs a component of that and put all of our energy on this Global 2000 use case. Mm-hmm. So from 2011 to 2013, I would say, is when we first hit stride. By the end of 2013, we had a meaningful understanding of how to sell to our customer. We had a meaningful understanding of the sales cycle, the buying patterns, and so on. And we also, at that point, also, I think, settled on the price point. We knew what it was to make an investment mm-hmm. in Apprenda because we spent 2 years calibrating that.
It's interesting. You started in 2007, and it's in 2013 that you really fully got an understanding of where the business was hitting its stride. That's 6 years. And I want to call that out to everybody who's listening. You know, building a strong, sustainable company is not an overnight affair. There's a lot of tweaking and, you know, chiseling and sculpting that goes on in building something that is scalable and meaningful. So you raised $55 million. What are current metrics of the business and how many customers, what kind of growth rate are you seeing, and where do you go from here?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we're about 120 employees. We're in the multiple dozens of enterprise customers, many more ISVs on top of that. So our focus has been how do you keep growing the number of initial customers who are deploying private and hybrid cloud? And then mm-hmm. within the existing customer base, how do you help them mature over time? So when we look at the metrics for the business, we do separate it out into acquiring new customers and then looking at the maturity and life cycle of those customers. And the reason that it's important to separate those is that you find that most customers who go through initial deployment of a technology like ours spend the first year really investing a lot of energy in changing their own internal culture to be more cloud-focused, changing some mm-hmm. of the processes they have. And then they really start to scale their investment because that's when they feel comfortable. So we do invest a lot of energy in making sure that there is that separation of maturity model, which is one metric for us, and how mature each customer is, as well as the new accounts that that we bring on board. You know, where do we go from here? So that's an interesting question because we're right in the midst of some pretty big and meaningful changes at Apprenda. We had our first acquisition about a month ago, so we bought a company named Kismatic. And Kismatic was headquartered out in San Francisco. They were focused on Kubernetes, which is Google's open source cloud platform. And you know, looking at that move, the reason that we did it is that we started to understand that the world evolves very quickly, obviously, and our enterprise customers were trying to look at things like Kubernetes and intersect them with Apprenda. How do these two things blend? And it was natural for us to acquire this technology and make what is becoming a macro trend, the use of something like Google's Kubernetes around Docker, part of our DNA. So for us, it's making sure that we keep realigning the business with customer need and with market change, because as soon as you forget about those two things, I think you're at significant risk as a business.
And what kind of average deal size do you start an account at, these enterprise accounts, now that you've hit the stride in the enterprise business? Where do you enter the market? Like, are you entering the market a customer and an account at about $100,000 price point, and then scaling the account to $1 million a year? Kind of, what does the evolution look like?
Yeah, so now that we have two products, I can walk you through that. We have our Kubernetes distribution and support services, and then our cloud platform, which also incorporates Kubernetes. On the cloud platform side, which is focused on more traditional platform as a service capability, our customers will typically make investments that are in the low six figures to start on the licensing side. Typically, another 10 or 15% they'd invest in services to help with that internal process change. And then after about a year to a year and a half, you'll find that the customer starts to scale their investments to the low seven figures. That tends mm-hmm. to be the point where they say, okay, you know, we've gotten comfortable with a initial scale of the technology, mm-hmm. and now we want to roll it out more broadly across the organization. So, yeah, we do scale into the millions after that first year or so of working with the customer.
And is it a per-user, per-enterprise user pricing model?
No, we actually charge per application deployed on the platform. So it's a subscription fee, and it's per application per year.
I see. All right. Last question. What do you think of this unicorn mania? Are you a unicorn? How do you read this whole trend?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting question. So it's a dual-headed beast, right? I think that aspiring to be a unicorn for the sake of valuation is actually a really bad thing. It leads to the wrong type of business behavior. Yeah, it's the complete wrong business behavior. If you become a unicorn, you know, you have a valuation of $1 billion as a consequence of solid business metrics, then that's something you should aspire to. So I think what's happened is that in some cases, people have resorted their priorities where valuation is the most important thing, and it creates lots of artificial and inorganic outcomes. So I don't like it per se. Now, what I do like is that the market is willing to accept companies that may have started just a few years ago and assign a valuation that are in the hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. And if, again, that those businesses are rooted in really solid business metrics, good revenue, happy customers, then it's well-deserved, and, you know, kudos to those companies.
So where are you? What's your current situation?
So we're not quite a unicorn, but we're not far from it either. You know, the market has placed a lot of value on companies like Apprenda, where cloud platforms that are helping these organizations transform their businesses to become software companies are, I think, at the top of everybody's mind. Again, if you look at a company like Cisco or a Microsoft or an IBM, everybody's focused on one trend, which is digital transformation, and engines like Apprenda tend to power that. So I think if you put that in context, and that every Global 2000 company is going through this, and all the biggest technology vendors place their strategic value on digital transformation and becoming software businesses, you can imagine where Apprenda comes in terms of value.
Yeah, you would be a very prized acquisition for several of the large tech companies, and you probably can even go public before that, but it's a very strong chance that you would be an acquisition target relatively soon, no?
Well, or just a big independent business. It's pretty exciting to me to think about the fact that we can continue to scale this company and produce happy customers with good technology. That's something that I think people sometimes don't value enough. There's a lot of acquisition focus, and of course, you know, great acquisitions happen.
No, we value that tremendously. We are huge believers in building businesses with the fundamentals and so forth. And the other thing that I love in your story is that you're doing it in a different place where there is a real, you know, you have a real industry level impact. You build a real cloud company in upstate New York that creates the beginnings of a whole ecosystem potentially where more things will happen. There are a lot of new hubs developing, technology hubs developing all over the US, and it's companies like yours that are at the heart and soul of that. You know, if you look at what happened in the evolution of Utah, for instance, there were some early successes, cloud successes. Actually, Omniture was headquartered in Utah, and the success of Omniture, and eventually Omniture went public, and some years later it was acquired by Adobe. All of that, you know, created a huge pool of, you know, technology talent and knowledge over there, and now Utah has become a very active startup hub. So the evolution that you are spearheading at in New York, in upstate New York, is earlier, is at a much earlier stage of that cycle, but there's no reason not to be optimistic that you're going to be able to drive that through as well.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think it's pretty fascinating to see that happen. So I'm excited for entrepreneurs to have a kind of an upcoming era here where you don't have to be in a specific location. So long as you do have access to some of the fundamentals, you can control your destiny. And, you know, I hope at least the story is inspirational to people in that context, because in some cases people get discouraged just based on location, and that's not the greatest.
Absolutely, and more, I think your message is absolutely correct, and we give this message also. More and more, you're better off starting technology companies outside of Silicon Valley. You can come here to grow. You can move, you know, portion of your business to Silicon Valley or not, as you have shown, Sinclair, that you don't even need to move your headquarters to Silicon Valley to raise capital from here. People come here in search of capital, but do not let that be the driver of your decision making. It's actually a lot more efficient to build businesses and scale businesses outside of Silicon Valley than in Silicon Valley today. It's just the cost structure and the talent war is really, really unproductive here right now. Well, thank you, Sinclair, for coming and sharing your very inspiring story. We'll keep in touch and track how you're doing.
Thanks so much again. I really appreciate the time, and hopefully we get to do this again in 2-3 years.
Yep, absolutely. Good luck.